Thank you for joining us today at the Thai Podcast. Welcome to the show.
And I realized this is amazing to be behind the scenes preparing these surfaces for play, preparing the bunkers for play, setting the hole locations, cleaning up the leaves, fixing the divots. All of that was suddenly fascinating for me of how that was done and how we could make the course as good as possible. I just loved it.
And we're actually the elite tier of grass management, turf management. Is giving it the minimum required nutrients instead of the maximum. So that was a cool piece to pick up today. So we were talking before recording began about turf and agronomy and how we wanted to do an episode that takes a few things from the golf world, the turf world, the agronomy world, to the enjoyers of the game, the people who love playing golf courses and picking around golf course architecture and love being out with friends or family at a golf course, can appreciate what makes a golf course better than another. What better conditioning looks like, but you spent the majority of your adult life working on turf and principles inside and the practices that go into maintaining healthy turf. So want to break those things down and maybe help us learn a few things about the ground that we don't currently know. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, I'm excited to try to make this topic of interest to some people, because there's so much going on with golf course maintenance that I think a lot of the people that play golf don't realize. So and I think it's fascinating, and there's a lot of people that do think it's fascinating, but it's somehow not as widely known as it could be.
So below the turf there is the dirt, and so as we get into this episode today, Micah, what have you been drinking, eating, reading, and thinking recently?
Okay. Drinking whiskey soda.
Soda eating, choice?
Oh, I used to drink blended scotch. Like the standard drink in Thailand, if you, I think, would be like a black label and soda water, which is okay. Quite a refreshing drink when you're in a tropical climate and you want something that's cold and not too strong. And I'm just not going to drink a single malt in these kind of temperatures. It just it's something that's better in Dornoch, I think, where it's cool. I kind of like bourbon now, if I have a chance, I'll have bourbon. And also have that with soda water and have it cold. And then
doesn't warm you up quite as much.
No. For eating, there's a beautiful market near our condominium in Bangkok where I am right now. The market is must have 60 shops or something that are all like individual food vendors. So yesterday I had some grilled chicken and some grilled pork that was delicious. So I just go down there and get some local Thai food. Reading. I'm reading an excellent book now called One Fine Day, which is about September 29th, 1923. Which was a day when the British Empire was at its peak in terms of land area. So it goes across the empire it's 700 pages or so about the British Empire, which is quite interesting because there was golf in a lot of those places. You know, you look at Royal Calcutta Golf Club and various golf courses that have been present wherever the British Empire went. So that's quite interesting. And thinking of, I think about turf grass, I'm thinking right now about how to get the growth rate of the grass just right. I think what we learn in turf grass school, or what you learn in a turf grass textbook, is about the things that you need to do to take care of grass. You need to fertilize it, water it, mow it. So we learn about the work that we need to do, and people tend to think of it in that way. But I would like to think about it in terms of how fast do we need the grass to grow to produce the desired surface, and work backwards from that. And I keep trying to think of various iterations or various aspects of that idea to try to improve the way that we manage turf.
So how did you get there? Take me back to the very beginning, I guess. Where did the interest in turf begin? You were a golfer before, but how did you meet the maintenance turf side?
Yeah, I grew up in the Willamette Valley of Oregon in a rural area, and I was always interested in gardening and plants, but I was never interested so much in turf grass maintenance specifically. And I played golf quite a bit from about the age of 12, and then I got better quickly. So within 3 years or so, I could shoot par for 9 holes. And then I thought, okay, if I continue this trajectory, I'm going to play in college and then I'll go be a golf pro. And that's what I wanted to do. And I never thought about the golf course maintenance. I just thought about playing golf. And then my senior year of high school, I actually played worse than I had my junior year. And I realized, you know what? I used to be getting better. Now I'm regressing in my golf game. I don't think I can compete with these other guys. So I caddied at Waverly Country Club in Portland, Oregon, the summer after I graduated from high school. And I'd graduated from high school a year early. I'd skipped eighth grade. And so I had a year. I didn't have to like rush off to college, and I was going to work for a year and kind of figure out what I wanted to do. And I caddied that summer. They had the junior amateur that year, the Tiger Woods one. Mm. And at the end of the summer, I realized, well, I don't want to be a caddy for my whole life. And there was a job opening in the maintenance department. And I was not really excited about that, but my dad really encouraged me to apply and go do that work. And I'll tell you, from the very first day on the job, it was like a blindfold had been taken off from my eyes. And I realized, this is amazing to be behind the scenes, preparing these surfaces for play, preparing the bunkers for play, setting the hole locations, cleaning up the leaves, fixing the divots. All of that was suddenly fascinating for me, of how that was done and how we could make the course as good as possible. I just loved it. And so my boss at that time, Richard Schwabauer, he had a degree from Oregon State University, and he and some of the other people on the staff there, they saw my interest in this, and they encouraged me, after working on the grounds at Waverly Country Club, they said, why don't you go to Oregon State? And so I did that, enrolled in 1994, and that was it. But yeah, it was like love at first sight.
Mm. So this is something that there's still a disparity between this with maintenance programs, clubs, and courses across the U.S. But I think I disassociate the two sometimes. The pride in taking care of a surface that is inherently worth respect. Like, we think of the greatest golf courses in America and the world, and there's that feeling about them where, like, these are sacred grounds. This is something that's worth protecting, worth investing in. And yet maintenance can be a very thankless job sometimes, and it can feel like there's a bit of hierarchy, and we're doing this to please the membership, and these are simply tasks to execute. And I think a lot of people listening here have gotten the chance to be on some of those sacred grounds and to appreciate, like, wow, there must be a whole lot that goes into making a surface this playable. And I want to start, you know, this discussion there, where, you know, there's a variety of ways that maintenance crews approach maintenance and approach pleasing their membership and approach the checks and balances within getting all these tasks done. There's some that do it better than anybody else, and depends on the golf course and the inputs and the money and whatever. What are some practices that you see that are working, that are very good, have worked for a long time? And what are some things that are old ideas that we're still practicing, that the golf world is still practicing, that maybe aren't as efficient?
Well, that's a very big question. And I will just pick a couple of examples. The things that are working, I would say rolling. Rolling is something that's been done, you know, from the night, you know, ever since golfing started, I think. And rolling surfaces is, it really helps. It would make tees better. It would make fairways better. It would make greens better generally. Okay. So if we use the right type of roller, it's not going to compact the soil too much. It's going to make it smoother, and it's going to make it a better golfing surface. And there's a few other benefits that come with that. Sometimes it can help to reduce disease. And sometimes it can help to make the surfaces a little bit firmer. So I like rolling if you want something specific. And then if you want to go on the negative side and say things that I think are maybe not so efficient, I'm just going to be very general and say there's some things that get done kind of by ritual. Mm-hmm. And there's like these maintenance practices that get done because we've always done it that way. Now, my job, I'm a turf grass scientist, and so it's kind of my job to question everything. And so I just kind of naturally do that. But there's some things, like one of the common things that gets done is heavy application of potassium fertilizer. And that's kind of a worldwide phenomenon in turf grass. And the grass generally, no matter what kind of grass you have, you can assume that it's going to use about half as much potassium fertilizer as nitrogen. So the number one nutrient that grasses use is nitrogen. And the second one used in quantity is potassium. And potassium deficiency has all kinds of problems. If you don't have enough potassium, the grass will suffer from drought stress. It will wilt more easily. The grass won't be as traffic tolerant. The grass will have all kinds of problems with just being weak if it doesn't have enough potassium. And so people kind of flip that around and they say, okay, well, if we add potassium, then we'll make the grass stronger. If we add potassium, we'll make the grass better able to tolerate drought. If we add potassium, we will make the grass more disease resistant, and all of these ideas. And so people just apply potassium without thinking so much about how much the grass can actually use. The grass can only use half as much potassium as nitrogen. And I would say in turf grass, it's common for people to be applying 3, 4, 5 times as much potassium as the grass could ever use. So, and is that a huge problem? Does it make grass worse? Not really. In a few isolated cases, it could make grass worse. But what it does is that's taking away a little bit of time, because it takes time and working hours to apply that potassium. It also takes some mental energy, because greenkeeping is a big job. We never have enough time to do all of it. We could always find things that we could spend more money on, spend more time on, and mm-hmm. spend more mental energy on, about how to fix the bunker edges just right, or how to make those greens 6 inches faster, on the stint meter or something like that? How can we get better hole locations so we can spread the traffic around the green? You know, things that require some thought. And I look at some of the rituals, and I choose the potassium one as an example. That's something that takes time, money, and mental energy dealing with basically an imaginary problem. And those are the kind of things that I try to say, let's stop doing that and let's focus on things that matter and focus on things that really will have an effect on the golfing surface.
You've been around a lot of these crews, and I understand that your role is to look at the processes and the finished product to a certain degree. But to your knowledge, has agronomy, taking care of a golf course, all the line items on a budget for a year, have those increased? Has taking care of a golf course become more expensive per year?
I think yes, it has, because people working in the turfgrass industry tend to be underpaid. So, salaries go up, but, you know, there's still room for that to increase. There's been inflation. So that increases the cost of everything. There's a lot of new technology with equipment and with products that can be applied. So with that new technology, that increases the cost. The demands from the, you know, it's very competitive. It's a competitive industry. Mm-hmm. So the demands for good surfaces require more investment to produce good surfaces. Mm-hmm. And it the cost just goes up and up and up. And also you have to look at the surface area, you know, as golf courses get longer and as fairways get wider, that increases the costs, I think.
So, on a commensurate level, have turf conditions improved on par with how much more expensive or, how many more tools you need to maintain the turf? Are those two things on par?
No, I would say the conditions have improved more than the increasing cost. And so, I don't have any data on that, but you can look at old, you know, Shell's Wonderful World of Golf videos or something from the 1960s, 1970s. We can look at some data on what green speed measurements were. We can talk to old time greenkeepers about what mowing heights were and look at photos and we can realize, wow, the types of surfaces being produced these days are just incredible. And I think the conditions increase. So the quality of the conditions really increases more than the spend. And greenkeepers are, you know, golf course, I use the term greenkeeper and golf course superintendent interchangeably. Sometimes, you know, might be director of agronomy or whatever. But whoever's in, sometimes it's golf course manager, the person that's in charge of taking care of the golf course. They are very skilled at producing excellent surfaces all over the world. And they're really, really good at making use of the resources that are available to them.
So lead me into this conversation about MLSN, the thought behind that idea, and what does it exactly mean for a maintenance crew looking to maximize their budget?
Wow, we jump right into MLSN, the initialism for minimum levels for sustainable nutrition, which is a way to interpret soil tests for turf grass, because grass is growing in soil, it's getting nutrients in soil. So we test the soil to find out what nutrients need to be added as fertilizer and how many of those nutrients need to be added as fertilizer. So MLSN is a relatively new method. This was introduced in 2012. I'm one of the developers of that, together with Larry Stoll and Wendy Gelernter from Pace Turf, which I now own that company also, as Larry and Wendy have retired. We developed that in 2012 because we wanted to make sure that grass was supplied with all the nutrients that it needed so that we would have healthy turf. But also we wanted to make sure that we could avoid, if possible, any unnecessary fertilizer applications. So if you would use that method, what that means is for most places, they find that they would reduce their fertilizer amount applied. That also is going to reduce their fertilizer cost unless they change to a more expensive product. And it frees up some time and you have the same or better turf grass conditions. So that's very simply what it does.
So it's kind of like it's very first principles in nature, but just thinking about the opposite approach, which is very theoretical, very like educational. These are the sorts of practices that we need to adopt in this region, or particular zip code or weather. And we do these practices and we measure some of them. And based on what we see, we adjust to get the best turf possible. What this says is, no, we're just going to test the soil and do as little as we absolutely need to create a product that is actually good for golf, a playing surface that is actually good for golf. What were some of the early learnings when consulting with other turf grass managers about this idea?
When we first developed that, I actually thought that those nutrient levels were actually lower than what I was recommending at the time. So basically, the golf has been influenced by agriculture a lot. So I'm not going to quite answer your question exactly straight away, but I might loop around to answer it later. But you okay. can go back. A lot of people will have read, what's that collection of essays by Alistair McKenzie? It's essays that he wrote back in the 20s and maybe early 30s, and it was published.
The McKenzie Reader?
No, the something that was released like 20 years ago.
Interesting.
Okay. Anyway, he's got a quote in there that said, "One of the biggest problems you can make is applying too much fertilizer, and that the fundamental principle of greenkeeping." So this is a 100-year-old quote from Alistair McKenzie, and he says that the fundamental principle of greenkeeping is that the best golfing grass is on nutrient poor soils. On it, the best golfing turf is on soils that don't have so many nutrients in them, rather than in soils that are rich with nutrients. And that somehow, I think, got a little bit lost in the 1960s, 1970s, certainly in the United States in golf course maintenance, because that's when turf grass research really started in the U.S. at a serious level at a lot of the agricultural universities. Mm-hmm. And of course, these are in the crop and soil science department or in the agronomy department. And a lot of the focus then was on maximizing yield of agriculture crops, right? But that's kind of the mentality that a lot of the turf grass professors had also. It seems like if you look at what the fertilizer rates were, and people were evaluating turf grass based on color and how it looked. Mm-hmm. And so there was this trend to put more and more fertilizer. And then that got into all the textbooks. And that's the way soil tests tended to be recommended. And in fact, there's also a statement in one of the turf grass soil fertility books written by three famous turf grass professors. And they said that potassium and phosphorus recommendations for turf grass have been arbitrarily set to neat into a high level, meaning they're arbitrarily recommending a high amount of those nutrients, even if the soil has quite a bit in the soil already. The reason for that was not for an agronomic reason. It's not because the grass needs it. It's because the cost of fertilizer was not considered to be of very much importance for turf grass. Meaning, if you're growing a crop of corn or a crop of soybeans, you're trying to make a profit. So you don't want to over apply any fertilizer because it would reduce your profit. But for turf grass, that was considered not to be an issue. And so they arbitrarily set it high just to make sure that they don't have a deficiency. But you realize that this is going completely against the principle of Alistair McKenzie, who's saying we need to recognize that the best golfing surfaces are on poor soils, and over fertilizer is a big problem. And then in the UK, there's also the on links courses, there's the famous agronomist from the who's deceased now, but he's got Jim Arthur. The book is Practical Greenkeeping. So he was the agronomist for the RNA, he did a lot of the links courses and the Open Championship venues. And this, I think, was back in the 70s, 80s, early 90s. And he was a big proponent of not putting too much fertilizer. And he had very traditional greenkeeping advice, saying you never need to apply phosphorus, you never need to apply potassium. And that's kind of very different from what was recommended in America. But because America, you know, the architects from America, the consultants from America, the grasses from America have been used all over the world, and they influence turf grass management all over the world, we kind of end up with something where golf turf management has this built-in idea that we should apply relatively large amounts of nutrients and make sure that the grass is supplied with all these nutrients so that the grass can be healthy. So to answer your question now, what I found is there's a bit of resistance from some quarters because people have this built-in idea that, and rightly so, they want their grass to be healthy. They're scared that if they don't put these products, the grass won't be healthy. Mm-hmm. And then there's other people that are like, you know what? That makes so much sense. That's so logical, Micah, what you're saying. In fact, this is what I've been doing my whole career. You've just kind of formalized the system of how to think about this. But people say, thank you for this. This is working great. And people say the grass has never been better. So now we're 12 years into this, and this becomes widely used all over the world. Although there's still some people that don't quite buy into it. They're still skeptical, but seeing how it's used in Australia, in Europe, in America, in Canada, it's been quite a surprise. Because when we released this MLSN thing, we thought maybe nobody will ever do it. Nobody will use it. And it's been the opposite.
So I do want to briefly talk about some of your favorite turf conditions, and then I'd love to get into, we'll just start with the favorite turf conditions. Tell me about what it means to set metrics to what good turf is. Like, how do you determine what the standard for a quality turf is? What does that look like?
Well, that's a good question, and it's very site specific. You know, I've had the chance to work at the Open Championship a few times, and you know, anybody that's you'd see from watching on TV, or if you're involved with that, the green speed sometimes is 9.5 feet, 10 feet, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is because it can be very windy, and based on the wind forecast, the people setting up the tournament will make sure that those greens don't get too fast. But the target green speed there is relatively slow compared to what it would be at the Masters tournament or at the US Open or PGA Championship or something like that. So it's very site specific and it's event specific. And for me, what I like to do is, and these are called course maintenance standards. So it's really nice for a club to have course maintenance standards that may say it may vary by season. So in a certain time of the year, you may want to have certain standards, and it at other times of the year, because of weather conditions generally, you would say, well, we're not going to try to push green speed at this time of year, something like that. And then it's specific for the club based on the slope of the greens and how the membership likes to play. And then for putting greens, I like to look at green speed. I like to look at firmness. And more recently, I like to specifically put a number to the quality of the ball roll, the smoothness and the trueness of the ball roll across the surface.
So what does the measurement process of the smoothness and the other test, the bobble test, I think, where the ball deviates offline?
Yeah. So the bobble test is a simple visual measurement that at first everybody objects to, and they're like, that's too subjective. It's too subjective. And they're like, I want something. I want the USGA's GS3 ball, which is a new technology that's just released in the last year or so. And they're like, I want a machine to measure this for me. I don't want to trust my own eyes. But the thing is, any golfer, and this has been tested, if you look at dispersion, okay, if we mm-hmm. roll a golf ball across a recently core aerified green, the ball, it moves side to side, it bounces up and down, and a visual assessment of that is the quality of the ball roll is terrible. Okay, and we're not going to the bobble test here, but I think you and I as golfers, we would both agree. I mean, anybody, they don't like putting on aerified greens. The ball doesn't roll true and it doesn't roll smooth. And yet, if you set up a device and try to make a lot of 10 foot putts, you'll make just as many on a bad green, on a green that's recently been aerified, as you do on a perfect green, because the bounces even out.
Really?
And so that's quite problematic, because the dispersion is not what it should be, because if you just try to measure that. So what you can do is you can do a bobble test, and we can just visually score it. And so the bobble test is, you're looking at, does the ball leave the ground? That's called a bobble, which I think anybody can see after they've hit a putt. Did the ball bounce and leave the ground, or did it not leave the ground? Then the second thing you're looking at is chatter, which is where the ball still continues on the proper line, but mm-hmm. it's got a little bit of vertical deviation. It's just bouncing up and down just a little bit, but you don't see it. It's not like it hits a old ball mark or a piece of gravel and bounces off the ground. And then you look for snaking, which is when the ball makes lateral movements that are not expected, which is like, you know, hitting a spike mark or you know, hitting a grain of sand or something, or just curving strangely. If the green's soft enough and there's a big footprint, the ball could hit the heel print and take a 90 degree turn or 45 degree turn. So that's what the bobble test is. And there's a scoring scale for that. And so it gets a score of 10, which is absolutely perfect. And you can see this watching on TV too. I was watching some highlights from the Dubai Desert Classic, and I saw Rory McIlroy make like a 20-foot putt. And so they put the camera down behind the ball, and they're showing that putt in slow motion. And I'm watching that, and that particular putt was a 10. There's mm-hmm. absolutely no bobble, no chatter, and no snaking. But sometimes you can also watch on TV, and you often see on really fast greens, on really good greens that are prepared for tournaments, you will see some snaking at the end of the roll. And you'll often see chatter also, especially towards the end of the day. So when the leaders are playing and the greens have some footprints on them, you'll often see chatter. In fact, I was at the Australian Open, down at the Australian Golf Club, and I was measuring the green speed and assessing the bobble test a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I was measuring this before play, and at the end of the round. And when you go around the hole, it was a huge drop in the bobble test score because of how scuffed up that turf was getting and just all the traffic that goes across it.
Probably a fair rule addition was the spike mark rule, being able to tap down spike marks, because morning to afternoon, you're right, it's a big difference.
And it depends on the type of grass, and it depends on how firm the surfaces are. But it does tend to decline over the course of the day.
I really enjoyed your Tiff Eagle example, because you were on another podcast talking about how you tried this on, I think it was like sandy Tiff Eagle, and the bobble test performed horribly, but the greens happened to be running 11, 12, 13, something super fast. And, you know, it's not always about speed.
Yeah, I always assumed that that just measuring the green speed would be enough, because I thought you can't, I thought wrongly that you can't really get the speed that you're looking for if the ball isn't rolling relatively smooth and true. And for the most part, that generally tends to be the case, that if you get a nice green speed, the ball rolls pretty good. But there are numerous exceptions to that, and I saw that with Tiff Eagle, and that was in 2019. So I've only been advocating the measurement, the actual measurement, putting a number to the quality of the ball roll for 5 years now. But I saw that in 2019. I said, whoa, I'm missing something in my assessment of surface performance. And so the whole reason for measuring this is so that we can then come back and adjust the maintenance work. Because you think about a lot of the maintenance work, and I use this example all the time. You know, people say they put sand top dressing to make the greens better, and we do core aerification to make the greens better. We do venting, which is solitine aerification, to make the greens better. It's like, but there's no doubt it makes the greens worse in the short term. Because if you've got a golf tournament, you don't go out on Wednesday afternoon after the pro-am and say, okay, tournament starts tomorrow, let's put some sand on these greens. And you don't say, okay, you know, let's make these greens better by punching holes in them. Nobody does that. In fact, you stop all of that stuff some weeks in advance of the tournament to make sure that the surfaces don't have sand on them during the tournament, and to make sure that there's no effect of previous aeration holes. And what I've noticed is, and I noticed this playing golf in Thailand specifically, and I can't say if it's this way all over the world, but we got to the point where we're doing so much work to make the greens better that every time I went to play golf, the greens had sand on it, or there was some residue of holes being punched, some visual tale that this had been done last week or 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. So the greens were never good. And I thought, wait a second, and I was contributing to that problem by going around and recommending all of these maintenance practices. And then I'm like, wait a second, if we're doing all this work to make the greens better, when are they going to get better? And so then since then, I've been more and more focused on measuring the playing conditions and then saying, let's only do the work that's necessary to improve them. But of course, sometimes we have to make it worse. So basically it goes like this. We look at a 52 week year or a 365 day year or however long the golfing season is, wherever you are, and say, how do we meet those standards that we have for our facility? How do we maximize the number of days in the golfing season at our location where we meet that standard for our facility? And the idea would be that if we did that 44 out of 52 weeks this year, wouldn't it be nice if we could find a way, if we could adjust our practices so we could do it 45 out of 52 weeks next year?
And that's it.
Yeah, so that's where I'm coming from. And I think a lot of greenkeepers are thinking that way too. Nobody's going out there saying they're trying to make the surfaces worse. it's just I'm doing work that kind of tries to put a logic to it and say, okay, here's a system. If you want to do it this way, here's a system that we can try to employ to really precisely figure out exactly what we need to do to achieve that 45 weeks next year instead of 44.
And now a quick word about our friends at Good Walk Coffee. Mr. Simas, what's your coffee game been like recently?
Man, I always, and I mean always, have the Mudball Half Calf on me. I've been loving the bump and run cold brews on the go, and lately, it's been the breakfast ball.
Give me a little bit more color on the bump and run cold brew.
Well, I love making coffee at home, but I can't do it all the time. And when I really got to move and I need my Good Walk, I reach straight in the fridge, grab a can, and go, and I get exactly what I need.
Where can the people go if they want to get involved with our friends at Good Walk Coffee?
You can purchase all your coffee, cold brew, espresso, pods, cases, beans, merch, and more for 20% off using code THETIE. That is THETIE at checkout. Set your custom subscription. The world is yours only at goodwalkcoffee.com.
Is the United States the primary country that suffers from the green grass problem, or do you see that elsewhere?
In some Asian countries, it would be common. I would say it's probably global.
Okay.
Because you've got counterexamples in the United States also. You know, I don't think sand hills or abandoned dunes are are too worried about color. In fact, there's counterexamples. And you can go to places in around London, I suppose, that are concerned about the way the golf course looks.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, we can think of it as certainly an American influence.
Okay. And then this other idea, when we were talking about sand and Alistair McKenzie's quote, and the idea that a plant that has barely what it needs actually plays better than one who has everything it needs. And I want to go to the idea of, you know, sand being better for drainage. Like, yes, I'm sure it is. Can you add some more context there as far as organic material and like, what is sand doing for the plant aside from drainage that's advantageous to the golf playing surface?
Well, I think if we think about design, sand sometimes has some natural landforms that are quite good for golf. So that's why, you know, links courses and courses that are built on old sand dunes often have some really interesting landforms. So it's just interesting from an architectural perspective. And then you get good water movement, so the surfaces can be relatively dry. And if it does rain, you can still play golf. So that's quite good. The other benefit for sand, the benefit of sand, which is why it's used in addition to the water movement and the drainage, is its resistance to compaction, because those sand particles can only fit together so tightly. But if you have a clay soil or a silt clay soil or a loam soil, if you put enough traffic across it, you can compact it so much that the roots can't grow very well. And then you eventually have bare ground because the grass can't grow. So it's nice to have sand for that resistance to compaction benefit also. And then as a golfing surface, if you don't over fertilize it, then you get grass that's growing relatively slowly. And grass that's growing relatively slowly tends to allow a golf ball to bounce and roll across it better than a really lush, rapidly growing grass with thick, succulent leaves. And so the sand can be quite good for that. And that's where you get the beautiful turf of the links courses in the British Isles, or the beautiful turf on the fairways at Chambers Bay, or the beautiful turf on the fairways at Old MacDonald or something like that. And so those are sandy soils and the turf is not over fertilized and the right grass is used there. So then you get this really nice ball bounce and roll. But the problem that you have with sand is it doesn't have very many nutrients and it doesn't hold very much water. So to keep the grass alive, you have to apply some fertilizer, especially you have to apply nitrogen at some point because that's what makes the grass grow. And you have to apply water generally if it doesn't rain in order to keep the grass from going completely dormant. And both water and nitrogen cause the grass to grow. As the grass grows, it grows above ground and it grows below ground. And below ground, it's producing what we call organic matter, which is living and dead old plant material. And if you get too much of that, it's thatch. And because that's happening underground, sometimes it can accumulate without you really realizing it if you're not paying attention. And that happens in people's lawns, for example, that nobody's really checking the thatch accumulation in their lawns. And the problem is in a sand root zone, you don't have so much, you don't have as much worm activity as you would in a loamy soil. You don't have quite as much microbial activity in a loamy soil as you would in a loamy soil. And so if you overdo the nitrogen fertilizer specifically and the water, you can grow the grass too fast. And that's something that what we get taught in school and what we get taught in, you know, just working on golf courses, we get taught how to grow grass. So we get taught how to make that fertilizer application, how to operate the irrigation system, how to go hand water the dry spots. There hasn't been so much focus on playability only and working backwards from there, and growth rate only and working backwards from there. And so what I've done in my career is kind of transition from that point where I was doing things in a very textbook way. And I was trying to share around the world, these are the best management practices for growing good, healthy turf grass. And just thinking that's going to lead to good playing conditions. But I wasn't measuring the playing conditions so much. And I wasn't checking some of the things that we really need to do to push to have those great playing conditions. Because hopefully I'm not losing anybody here, but it becomes very risky growing grass in sand. It becomes very risky to cut the water too low, because if the water is too low, the grass will die in a way that it would not in a loamy soil. And if we cut the fertilizer too much, the grass will starve and become unhealthy in a way that it wouldn't in a loamy soil. And those things can happen faster than they would in a regular soil. So as we have more and more sand, and now we're not just talking about sandy sites, but we're talking about USGA green construction or California method green construction. It's really common all over the world now to have putting greens, at least, that are either constructed originally with a sand root zone to get those benefits that we talked about previously, resistance to compaction and rapid infiltration of water down through the top of the root zone. Or if they weren't constructed that way, they've been top dressed over 10, 20, 30, 50 years. They've been top dressed with sand. So you get a layer of sand at the surface. So essentially for putting greens all over the world, we're growing that grass in sand. And because professional turf grass managers know what happens if a green gets too dry, now you've got a big problem on your hands. And if the grass doesn't grow fast enough, then you have a big problem on your hands. It'll thin out. You get algae, you get moss, you get all kinds of problems. Mm-hmm. And so are we the really good greenkeepers? They know how to do this by feel. But if somebody from Sri Lanka or Pakistan contacts me and says, how much fertilizer should I be putting on my greens this year? How do I give an answer to that? Well, the way that I've figured out to give an answer, not just to people in Sri Lanka or in Pakistan, but it turns out I can give answers to people all over the world, and people who like to do turf management this way, they find it interesting. They can say, okay, we can use MLSN. That's that soil test interpretation method we can use. We can use clipping volume, which is actually measuring how many clippings we're producing above ground, because the clippings get harvested from putting greens into a basket on the front of the mower. That basket needs to get emptied. We can measure what the volume of those clippings were. From that volume, we can estimate what the mass of the clippings was. And there's so much utility in that, from because we can find out where that edge of the cliff is, where the grass might be growing too slow. But if we're not measuring it, you can't tell how close to the edge you are. And because greenkeepers know the world over that if the grass grows too slow, they will be out of a job, because although golfers might think slower, 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 but at some point, divots don't recover, ball marks don't recover, you have algae on the greens, you have all kinds of problems. So you have to keep the grass growing to deal with the traffic at some rate. But to find what that minimum rate is, it's really useful to actually measure it. So that's where clipping volume comes in. And then more recently, I've also been looking at measuring exactly what's happening in the soil with the total organic material. So now we can measure what the change in time is in organic material in the soil. So now we can get an estimate of what the growth rate is below ground also. So all of these tools now allow anyone to maybe push it a little bit closer to the edge, and then make decisions about, is this top dressing necessary? Is this fertilizer necessary? Should I adjust my fertilizer rate? Just in a slightly more precise way. And that's kind of what my specialty is thinking about things in that way, and then trying to communicate them and convince greenkeepers the world over to have a try at using the aspects of this philosophy that will be useful at their facility.
Well, it must be a joy with all the inputs required in maintaining a golf course, knowing that every input you do, every measurement you take, even though it might be a lot of work in the short term, maybe it's not. Knowing that you are getting closer and closer and closer to the right answer is cool. And also learning that the status quo is learning how to produce healthy grass. And we're actually the elite tier of grass management, turf management, is giving it the minimum required nutrients instead of the maximum. So that was a cool piece to pick up today. As we close out the episode, I'm curious what the holy grail of turf conditions are to you. Like, you've been all over the world, you've worked in lots of places. As a golfer and as somebody who studies turf grass, what to you is the best that the game has to offer?
Oh my, that people ask me what's my favorite golf course. I don't know that somebody's asked me that question about what my favorite turf conditions are.
And it is subjective, because, you know, you'd have to be there. We talked about seasons earlier. You'd have to be there in the right season, but it's worth an ask.
Does it all have to be at one place, or I can pick a certain tee, certain fairway, certain green?
No, you can take this any way you want. It does not have to be that in a box.
I like some of the Zoysia fairways in Japan. I think that can be really superb, especially in autumn. So if you see Zoysia fairways in Japan in autumn, after they've had a chance to grow nicely all through the year, and then get some traffic, maybe some rolling to push that grass down, that can be a really, really nice surface. And the grass will be growing slowly enough at that time of the year that you get a lot of roll. I like Poa Annua greens to putt on myself. I think I'd rather manage bent grass, and I'd rather consult on bent grass, and I'd rather watch other people grow bent grass. But if if I would go play golf, you know, I'd like to play Eastmoreland in Portland or Waverly Country Club in Portland or Columbia Edgewater in Portland, Royal Oaks up in Vancouver, you know, those kind of clubs that have nice Poa Annua greens. That's just a surface that I feel really comfortable putting on. And, you know, visually, that's a surface that I just feel like I can make a lot of putts. And then, yeah, but I guess for tees, it is the same. I like some of the Zoysia tees in Japan.
Zoysia is great. I'm from the Carolinas, and so we've seen a lot of Zoysia poke up, you know, in the Southeast U.S. And at its best, I agree with you. It can be very, very good. They even have it on a couple greens at places that have struggled with Bermuda or get a lot of play. That's something that I've seen a lot, which makes sense. It's like if you get a ton of traffic and you don't need green speeds to be 11, Zoysia is really a great option for that too.
Yeah, it's a nice grass to stay alive and be pretty. Mm-hmm. It's not a grass that you really can get really nice green speeds with.
Mm-hmm.
But the newest varieties of Zoysia are better than the older varieties in terms of putting greens.
It's an odd concept. I mean, the first time I saw it, I said, my dream putting green is certainly not Zoysia, but there are certain courses where, going back to what you said earlier, right? Like every course requires something different from its community or its membership or whatever. And, you know, a par three course or a short little municipal course that is packed all day long and is a home for new golfers, you know, it rolls, you know, 8.5 to 10 on the stimp meter, and they're smooth enough and they handle the traffic really well. I think that's a great thing. And bent grass, I agree with you. Poana, at their best, very, very fun putting surfaces. And also Bermuda, you know, I think I grew up around a lot of bad Bermuda. Like I've gotten the chance to watch the agronomy really improve with Bermuda greens in the Southeast. And I don't know if it was the reduction of thatch as much as it was something else. But it, going back to your comment about Abu Dhabi, like it seems like the best version, the competitive events with really fast and firm Bermuda greens with not a lot of thatch or grain it's hard to beat no matter what time of the year it is.
Yeah. I think, I understand Tiger Woods has a practice facility at his home, and I think he has the ability, to control the micro environment in such a way that he could have any type of grass that he would want there. And it's my understanding that he has Bermuda grass on the greens. And, you know, but it's technically possible to have any kind of grass because you can put in a refrigeration system or something to grow cool season grass there if you wanted to. And I think that says something for the quality of the surfaces that you can get with well-maintained Bermuda grass.
That's a really interesting call out. You know, Tiger's done well on the golf course. I didn't know that refrigerated lawn was on the list of possibilities, but you shouldn't put anything past him. That's a great call out.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that is not the most sustainable thing to do. It would require a lot of electricity and a lot of pesticides to prevent diseases. And that's one of the problems that I see is people find a grass that they like and then they push it into new areas. And, you know, it's interesting in Portugal, just south of Lisbon, there's that new David McClay Kid course that's got fine fescue fairways. And then there's a Discovery Land project that has Zeon Zoysia fairways. So you've got a cool season grass And not just like a regular cool season grass, but the type of cool season grass that we think of as a Scottish grass or a Nordic, a Scandinavian type of climate grass, now down south of Lisbon. And then you've also got a warm season grass that is kind of like a tropical grass in some ways, which is Zoysia Metrella, also planted. And those courses are right next to each other, they're in the same area of Portugal, and both of those are relatively new courses. I'm really interested in seeing which one of those works and how. I'm not sure that either of those are the right choice for those locations, but I'll find out. It's nice. All this happens publicly because we see what grasses get chosen, and so we can see, you know, if fescue greens work at Chambers Bay or, you know, things like that. And then you see, oh, well, I guess that changed. And in my business, seeing which grasses work well in certain areas is quite interesting, because the problem that we would have with playability, and it makes a problem for golfers, it makes a problem for the owner who's invested in the project, and it makes a problem with playability for the golfers, and it makes a big problem for the superintendent who has to do a lot of extra work. If you choose the wrong grass, then you're not able to achieve what you want to in terms of playability, or you have to spend a lot more money in order to achieve it. And so you see some of these grasses get pushed. Like I'm real interested in the Brambles project in Napa, which is, you know, Zoysia greens, and you're just like, okay, why? Zoysia Metrella tees and fairways in that climate, it's really borderline. I've written blog posts about this saying, you know, why do we find wild Bermuda grass growing wild? You go to Pebble Beach, there's Bermuda grass growing wild in a lot of places. I've looked for Zoysia, can't find it. I know there was Zoysia planted at Spyglass Hill. I've been over there looking for it, can't find any remainders of it. But what do you find growing wild there? I mean, obviously that's on the coast, but that what you find is Bermuda grass, and then you wonder, why do we need Zoysia north of San Francisco? But maybe that will turn out to be a brilliant decision. So that's the nice thing about golf and grass selection. We can always find out.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that Brambles was going with Zoysia greens, or fairways for that matter. I will say that piece of land looks amazing, incredible. What a landscape to build golf in. But it has been interesting looking from the outside in, because I've seen photos of the golf course. I don't know anything about the superintendent or the agronomy team, don't claim to, but what I've seen is a very slow and steady approach to building that golf course, and a lot of great people, you know, knowledgeable people behind it. So that's cool hearing about the grass. Well, give them the benefit of the doubt. I think it'll work out. They seem to have gotten everything right so far.
Yeah. Well, the pictures look nice. So yeah, people who play there can report back.
I'll be interested. But to hear
yeah,
that,
I too. Mean, we'll see 10 years from now or something. Cause if I could just say one more thing, like the big picture, what we try to do, is try to have the best surfaces, but what we should do looking into the future, and in terms of just property management, is try to use the least amount of fuel possible, the least amount of water possible, the least amount of pesticides possible, the least amount of electricity possible, and so on, to manage the property for golf. That's the best thing that we can do. And we should store the largest amount of carbon that we can in the soil, right? So we should have more carbon stored. Grasses are great at storing carbon in the soil, so it's pretty good for carbon sequestration. So that's generally the idea of what we should try to do. And we should apply as little pesticides as possible and use as little water as possible. That's the general principle about what sustainable golf course management is. And grass selection, the way we maintain is one thing, but the grass selection sometimes has a controlling effect on that. Because if you'd plant a fine fescue, or let's say you have Poa annua in Dallas, it's going to need a lot of water, a lot more water than if you have Bermuda grass, for example. And so Poa annua would be a particularly poor choice in Dallas, even though that's my favorite putting surface.
Well said. I look forward to getting you back on here. If we have another, you know, Chambers Bay green situation, we need to call you in. But this was really fun. I hope we get the chance to do it again. You're in Bangkok right now. When are you back in the U.S.?
I'm gonna make a 2-day visit end of February, on my way to Montreal, for the Canadian show. And then I'll be at the Masters. So I'll be in the US for the Masters and, for some associated, stuff around that time.
Cool. We'll get all your links in the show notes so people can go find you. Micah, thank you for the time today. Really enjoyed hearing and learning from you.
Thank you very much, Walker. I enjoyed this conversation.